Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking about the science of searching for exoplanets with a couple of scientists from the Kepler mission. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 146, recorded on Thursday, May 31st, 2012. A disintegrating signal. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and this is the show where you get to dig into a single topic in the sciences for an entire hour, or at least the better part of an hour. It's a lot of science, one topic, excitement. You might learn a lot. You might learn a little, but you can enjoy. And today, instead of having just a single guest, we have a special. That's right, two guests. For the price of one, which, you know, because this is a podcast, it's absolutely free. So you get double the enjoyment from that. We are going to be speaking with researchers who are involved in the Kepler mission about the science of searching for exoplanets. We'll be talking with Drs. Eugene Chang from UC Berkeley and John Jenkins from the SETI Institute. And that's going to be happening in just a few minutes when you're ready to get in and get dirty with the science. But first, a few science headlines. It's May 31st, 2012, and this is the science that made headlines this week. Amid both uproar and appreciation, 23andMe, a popular genetics testing company, announced its first patent this week on a genetic variant of the SGK1 gene that might be protective against Parkinson's disease for individuals with a rare risk-associated mutation in a gene called LRRK2. The company says that the patent is necessary for future drug development research. Sequencing of the tomato genome was completed and published in the journal Nature. Researchers involved in the project hope that it will lead to the development of a tastier tomato and boost conventional breeding over genetic modifications. In the name of healing everything that goes wrong in laboratory rodents, a Swiss team of scientists restored full range of motion to paralyzed rats. The rats' spinal cords have been severed to simulate spinal injury in humans. Within weeks of starting a regime of electrical and chemical spinal cord stimulation and robotic support, the rats fully recovered and are described by the scientists as athletes. Human trials are hoped to begin in the next year or two. A paper in Science describes a computer model created to predict pragmatic reasoning in language, which is a step closer to computers that can understand human language and the complexities of inference, context, and social rules. The model is based on how listeners understand speakers and how speakers decide what to say, says one of the authors, Noah Goodman from Stanford University. Harvard University biologists published a study in Nature that analyzed fossils of bird-like dinosaurs and primitive birds to learn that birds really are dinosaurs, juvenile dinosaurs. Their study suggests that birds evolved as some species of theropod dinosaurs sped up their developmental pace. Instead of taking months or years to mature, birds very often take weeks, and physically they resemble the juveniles of their ancestors. SETI published its very first long baseline interferometric experiment in the Astronomical Journal, reporting no discovery of signals from intelligent aliens. Sorry, folks. The study used the Australian Long Baseline Array pointed at the star Gliese 581 for 8 hours in June of 2007 and found 222 candidate signals, but determined them to be from Earth-orbiting satellites. In honor of the Olympic Games in London, British chemists developed a synthetic molecule in the shape of Olympic rings. The molecule with five linked rings was imaged using non-contact atomic force microscopy and is called, wait for it, Olympicine. Everyone get ready. It'll be a great summer games. Volvo completed a 200-kilometer test drive of its self-driving road train. That's right. I was just going to say car, but no, road train in Spain this week. The convoy of three cars were wirelessly linked to each other and followed by a lead vehicle driven by a professional driver. The test was part of a European Commission project called SARTRA, Safe Road Transit for the Environment. Scientists in Ireland at the University of Limerick solved one of the most important questions currently facing humanity. Why, oh why, did the bubbles in a pint of Guinness sink to the bottom of the glass instead of just rising to the top? The answer lies in the geometry of the Guinness glass. The sloping sides of the glass set up a circulation where the liquid in the glass flows downward near the walls and up in the center. The flow of the liquid creates drag on the bubbles and pulls them down. The team of physicists get points in my book for using the terms pint and anti-pint. And I kind of wonder if they ever met in the real world, would they annihilate one another? These are the things you have to think about every once in a while. After successfully completing its mission to the International Space Station, the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft re-entered the Earth's atmosphere and splashed down off the California coast at 11:42 a.m. Eastern Time this morning. Congratulations on an history-making achievement, SpaceX. And in other commercial space news, the FAA cleared Spaceship Two to begin rocket-powered suborbital test flights. Spaceship Two is a six-passenger spacecraft owned by Virgin Galactic, manufactured by Scaled Composites. The permit allows Scaled Composites to fly only test pilots, not passengers at this point. But Virgin Galactic has sold about 500 tickets for the $200,000 rides, the dates of which have not yet been set. And that does it for the science headlines this week. Let me know what you think about these science news stories or what you think should be news by emailing me, drkiki@drkiki.tv, or leave me a voicemail at 650-741-5454. That's Kiki, 741-Kiki. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. And all three of those things, it's pretty great to save. There are several easy ways to instantly access Netflix. You can access the TV shows and movies that they have in their catalog on your Mac or your PC, your iPad if you have an iPad app, iPhone if you have an iPhone app, and even some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, a PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV using a set-top box like Apple TV or the Roku box. These are inexpensive and very easy to use. And with Netflix, you can watch all the movies and TV that you want instantly with any of these devices, and you can start on any one of the devices, stop at any point, and then pick up right where you left off on another device. It's a really seamless interface. I happen to appreciate it immensely, especially when I'm trying to sedate my toddler son with with toddler programming. Anyway, whichever way you decide to access Netflix, you can watch as much as you want, anytime you want. And if you don't like the service, you can cancel at any time for free. However, to get you into it, Netflix is offering a special offer for viewers of Twit, a free 30-day trial. It's free 30-day trial. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you try and sign up. It's netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. We would like to thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. It's time to get back to the show and into our conversation of the hour. I'd like to introduce my guests today. Dr. Eugene Chang received his undergraduate degree in physics from MIT in 1995 and his PhD in astronomy from Caltech in 2000. He's a professor of astronomy and of Earth and planetary sciences and teaches a variety of classes in the astronomy department, ranging from introductory astrophysics for undergraduate majors to fluid mechanics and radiative processes for graduate students to graduate seminars on galactic and planetary dynamics. The most challenging and most rewarding class he teaches is order of magnitude physics, in which the class tries to estimate any quantity under the sun to within a factor of 10. He also wrote a play in which the archive preprint server Cron achieves sentience. I think that's something I might like to see. And our other guest, Dr. John Jenkins, is a research scientist for the SETI Institute at NASA Ames Research Center, where he conducts research on data processing and detection algorithms for discovering transiting extrasolar planets. He's the analysis lead and co-investigator for data analysis for NASA Discovery Program's Kepler mission. He received his PhD at Georgia Tech by studying the atmosphere of Venus with data from the Pioneer Venus orbiter. He moved to the Bay Area after graduation in April of 1992 to join the SETI Institute as a principal investigator. In 2010, Dr. Jenkins received NASA's Exceptional Technology Achievement Medal for his numerous technical achievements throughout development, commissioning, and operational phases, which have been critical to the success of Kepler. And I just want to thank you both for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Kiki.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It's wonderful to have you on here. And I am very excited to talk about the Kepler mission because everybody wants to know. I mean, the big question about that the Kepler mission is digging into is, are there other Earth-like planets that could support sentient life out there? Right? That's the big question. John?
Absolutely. That's what we all want to know. And we all can't wait to find the answer to this question. So I think we're all very fortunate to be at this place at this time when the answer to this question is just around the corner.
How far around the corner really do you think we are?
Well, I think we're within a couple of years of understanding the basic answer to the question, what is the prevalence or frequency of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of sun-like stars in our galaxy?
That's soon. I like it.
It is. And to be specific, when we say habitable zone, we're talking about that range of distances from a star for which liquid water would pool on the surface of a planet. So we are indeed looking for worlds that could be Earth-like, but determining whether they are Earth-like is something that we have to leave to the next generation of astronomers and spacecraft and instruments.
So tell me how you specifically got into the Kepler project. What was your path with working with SETI and then moving from studying Venus to studying extrasolar planets?
Well, back as a graduate student at Georgia Tech, I was working on data from the Pioneer Venus probe, the orbiter actually, to study the Venusian atmosphere and understand more about the sulfuric acid vapor below the cloud layer, which the cloud is made of sulfuric acid droplets. And it was about that time that I fell in with bad company. Bill Borucki was a co-investigator on Pioneer Venus, and he was studying lightning in the atmosphere of Venus. And he became the principal investigator and the chief promoter of the Kepler mission. And after I moved to Ames Research Center in 1992, I quite fortuitously became involved with a small team of astronomers who at that time were trying to conduct a worldwide campaign to detect extrasolar planets orbiting the smallest known eclipsing binary at the time, CM Draconis. And while we valiantly worked hard for several years, about 6 years collecting data, we did not detect any planets, although we set strong upper limits on the size of any planet in that system. And that work brought me to the attention of Bill, who invited me to join his team in 1995. And so from that point forward, my job was to develop and design the processing algorithms and the pipeline that we use to process the data to change pixels into planets from Kepler.
I love that. I love that quote. I've seen it other places around the web in relation to you. The idea that you're taking pixels and turning them into planets. How do you make that leap?
Well, it's actually very simple in terms of the concept. What Kepler does is it stares nearly continuously at a fixed place on the sky that's about the size of the palm of your hand held at arm's length. So we're staring at 100 square degrees of the sky, 1/400th of the total sky, and we're observing 156,000 or so stars simultaneously. And all we're doing is snapping images of the star field every 6 seconds, and we add those images together for half an hour. And once a month, we download just the postage stamps containing the images of each of these stars to the ground, where we actually then can process the data. It's mm-hmm. a lot of data, and we can't afford to store the entire field of view, the full image, which has about 95 million pixels in it. So it's kind of like taking your high school yearbook and just cutting out the portraits of your friends and pasting them onto another page and then throwing away the rest of the yearbook because that's all the stuff you're not interested in. And so that's where I'm sorry.
I was just laughing at the analogy there. It's kind of funny.
Right. So that's where the real work begins, because at that stage you have the raw pixel counts, just the raw image from the CCD, which is we have a focal plane composed of 42 CCDs. These are charge-coupled devices similar to those in your cell phone or digital camera. Ours are a little bit bigger than yours. Normal cell phone has one about the size of your thumbnail. Ours are each 1 inch by 2 inches across. And we have a number of calibration steps we have to perform to remove on-chip artifacts and perform various calibrations that are common to ground-based astronomy, and some of which are unique to Kepler. For example, we operate without a shutter, and it takes a half second to read out the image. So we get these vertical smear trails up and down our CCD on the image, and we have to calibrate and remove that effect before we can measure the brightness of each star. And that's the next step. We basically accomplish that simply by adding up the counts or the voltage on each pixel corresponding to how many photoelectrons were collected during that half-hour integration. So it's just numbers. We just add them up. And at that point, you have in each half-hour interval a measurement of the brightness of that star. Now it gets really interesting because we're looking for very weak signatures. Indeed, when an Earth-sized planet crosses in front of a Sun-sized star, the drop in brightness is the ratio of the area of the planet to the star. And Earth is about 100 times smaller than the Sun by radius. So we're looking for a drop in brightness that's about 1 part in 10,000, or a percent of a percent. And that's a very shallow signal. It's very weak. So we have to do a lot of work and effort to identify and remove instrumental signatures that might be competing with these shallow transits for attention by our software. So once we have done that, remove the instrumental artifacts, then we actually comb through the data with an algorithm that sifts through it, looking for instances where you have a periodic drop in brightness corresponding to a Keplerian clock, a planet crossing in front of a star periodically and regularly. Or it could be an eclipsing binary. And we have to then, after we detect such signals, then validate them and understand whether they're likely to be due to a planet crossing in front of a star, or whether it's more likely that it's due to a small star crossing in front of a larger star. So that's the back end of the process, is to construct a suite of diagnostic tests that examine the evidence and allow us to have either more or less confidence in the signature in terms of it being a planet or not.
Right.
So that's the full life cycle of pixel to planet.
And actually, it's just the idea that you can actually pull out the existence of a planet out of that kind of information is still rather mind-boggling. Eugene, can you tell me a bit about how you got involved in the Kepler mission?
Oh, everyone who's interested in planets is involved in the Kepler vision mission in some way. It's revolutionary. It's amazing to live in a time when you can actually tell people how many Earth-like planets there are in the galaxy and have data back you up. John noted correctly that in a few years, we will have the answer. Although with the Kepler data already, if you were a betting person, you can already extrapolate the answer. The answer is that they're everywhere. That there's, if I point to some random star in the sky, provided it's a sun-like star, it has an order unity probability, some 10%, 20%, 30% probability of having a planet just like the Earth, well, at least the size of the Earth, in an orbit like the Earth that is capable of sustaining liquid water. So everyone who's interested in planets is paying very close attention to the Kepler results.
And then you became involved in actually looking through the data, and you're not just paying attention to the results. You're actually interested in some of the stories that the data can tell.
Yeah, absolutely. So for this particular project of a disintegrating planet that I think will be the focus of today's episode, the way I got involved was through a colleague, Saul Rappaport, and former mentor, actually, from MIT. And he called me up one day, just a few months ago, I think in December. I was grading papers at the time, grading exams. And he said, have I got something for you to look at from the Kepler data stream? It really puzzles me. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I have a few ideas, but I'm not completely sure. I'd like to talk about it with you. I kept telling him that I was grading papers with my TAs and that I needed to get back to it. He seemed to ignore me. It was really, really irritating. But that's how I got involved. It was through a phone call. And after I was done grading papers, I looked at the data that he had given me, this light curve of this particular Kepler target. And it just blew me away. I'd never seen anything like it before. So that's how I got involved.
And you said, I want to look at this more deeply. I want to actually analyze this.
Well, I want to know what the heck it is.
Yeah.
That's what everyone wants to know. No one could agree. There was no real consensus on what it was. The light curve was bizarre in several ways. One of which is that it varied from eclipse to eclipse. One time it would dim out, the star would dim by 1%. And then the next eclipse, 16 hours later, it would dip by half of that. And then a few eclipses down the road, you wouldn't even see the eclipses at all. They would just disappear. So it was very erratic and strange. There are other peculiar features that we can talk about too, but that's the one that's most striking.
Yeah, and so when something is that erratic, how do you pull out the constancy of it, which is that there is a planet that's orbiting around its star, but there's something odd about that planet?
Oh yeah, the constancy of the period is well established. It's 15.685 hours from eclipse to eclipse. You can time it. You can set your set your watch by it. It's that precise. But what isn't precise is the depth of the eclipse. How much the star dims from transit to transit, and that can vary by 1%. To a maximum of something like 1.5% to less than 0.2%.
John, I was wondering, for the construction of the light curve and getting this erratic information out of the data, what actually happened to kind of come up with this signal that Eugene ended up getting his hands on and going, what is it?
Well, it actually happened automatically. Our system analyzes all of the data in a hands-off fashion and conducts the search for transit-like features. And what's very interesting about this particular light curve is that it is so bizarre, as Eugene just said. I've never seen another light curve like this. There are plenty of weird, bizarre stars out there doing weird, wacko things. And some of them actually sound really good when you play them through a sound card. But this one is just off the charts. And a very interesting point about this is that our transit detection software automatically detected the signature of this transit or eclipse-like feature each time we ran it on the data. But when the humans in our science team and our science office went through these stars, this list of stars with transit-like features, they saw that this was not behaving like an ordinary planet. And so it was discounted. It was just set to the side and ignored until Saul Rappaport and his team picked it up and said, what the heck is this? And in fact, the first question they had for me was, they came and talked to me, John, is this real or is it some instrumental glitch that's happening? We'd really like to believe it's real because there's got to be something novel, new here that begs for attention from astrophysicists. But until we know it's a real signal, then we don't know what to do with it. So that was the role I played in this particular discovery, was to conduct a suite of diagnostic checks against instrumental effects that might be causing this signature in the light curve that is so compelling and interesting. So, for example, we looked for whether there was a star likely to be in the background that might be an eclipsing binary or some other weird variable star. And we do that by looking at the apparent motion of this star on each frame over time to see if there is a correlation between the change in the brightness of the star and the apparent location of the star on the CCD. And that proved not to be the case. So at the source of this intrinsic variability, if it's not this star, it must be so close on the sky to the star we can't tell from the Kepler data. We also looked for whether we were seeing video crosstalk. Because we have a mosaic focal plane, it means that we're reading out CCDs simultaneously. And because all the electronics are close together on these 16 or 18 layer circuit boards, you can get crosstalk or signatures or signals from one amplifier on the output of a CCD getting into the video chain and getting injected or added to the readout of another CCD. And this happens largely on each module, which has four channels being read out simultaneously. And the good news is that we know exactly which pixels affect which pixels on the other CCDs, and we can do a visual inspection on a full frame image to see whether there's a source that's likely to be crosstalked or likely to be contaminating the light curve that you're looking at. And that proved not to be the case either. In fact, we looked at everything we could think of. We looked at whether the cosmic ray detection algorithm was finding cosmic rays preferentially in transit or out of transit, and it was not. So it passed all the checks that we could think of, and that's when Saul and his team and Eugene really went to work once they had confidence that this was an intrinsic variation in the light output from the star and not something that was due to something happening funny on the spacecraft.
I'd only learned about it. Sorry.
Go ahead, Eugene. Go ahead.
I just wanted to follow up on that. I had only learned about the source after John had done all this exhaustive series of checks. As a theorist, you're really grateful for all these data analysis checks to confirm that the signal is real. But I can't tell you how many times I've worked on things that later on turned out to be wrong, to be false. Not from any fault of my own, but from the fault of the observers. So this was the case that was not like that.
Yeah, I was just the big story in particle physics in the last year was the idea of faster than light neutrinos, which scientists came out and they said, we think we've got this really incredible result. We want to troubleshoot it and figure out what it might be. And then they went back to the drawing board and started doing all those checks. They started looking and looking and looking and finally found out it was an equipment error. And so the faster than light neutrinos don't exist, or at least we haven't found them if they do. And so it just, this is a much, much handier, it's a very similar tale, but just going to figure out, you know, okay, is this something, this is an odd result. Is this something that we've done wrong, or is it actually something we should be looking into? Because the technology you're using is pretty complex.
Well, it is. And indeed, this is a very sensitive instrument. It's much more sensitive than any other photometer that's ever been built and launched. And we're extremely sensitive. So even what normally would be small, insignificant changes in the environment on the spacecraft and the telescope impact the data. For example, early in the mission, we noticed that there were oscillations that kind of looked like they were triangle waves, and they were becoming more and more frequent over time. And we traced that back to a heater on one of the reaction wheel assemblies that was turning on to keep the reaction wheels in their proper temperature range. And that's critical to the operation of this spacecraft, because the reaction wheels are like gyroscopes. They actually control the pointing of the spacecraft and the telescope. But when the heater came on, it was changing the temperature of this box on the side of the spacecraft by 5 degrees Celsius. And that was changing the shape of the telescope so that the distance between the primary mirror and the focal plane, which are normally 1.4 meters apart, was changing by 0.1 micrometers. And we could see that easily by eye and the data at the pixel level. And so normally a change by about a part in 10 million is something that you can afford to neglect as an engineer, or in most cases as a scientist. But in this case, it's a booming signal to this very sensitive instrument. So we have to be very careful and cautious when we see things in the data that aren't things that we've expected and learned to love, or at least deal with.
And now we've got this amazing story that NASA has released, you guys have published, of this the tale, the dusty tale of this disintegrating planet, if we want to put a story spin on it, that this odd signal that turned out to be something actually, there's a planet around a star, it's real, and it's odd, it's disintegrating. And can Eugene, actually, maybe you should tell the rest of the story of, you know, what you learned, what as a theorist you've been able to pull from that light curve and where you've been able to go with this story.
Yeah, sure. So the first thing to note about it is the depth of the eclipse. So at maximum, it's 1%. That is, it dims the star's light by at most 1%. And John noted before, he explained before that, you know, the depth of the eclipse is, of course, related to the size of the object that's passing in front of the star. So in the case of a 1% dip, that's booming to Kepler, right, which is built to be to detect signals that are much weaker. But 1%, that's a booming signal. That comes from would come ordinarily from a giant planet, one whose size is comparable to Jupiter. So a really big one. The problem with that interpretation, that's sort of the obvious one that you might first think of. The problem with that is that you have to get rid of it on the next eclipse, because the depth varies from orbit to orbit. So 15.7 hours later, suddenly it's gone. So where did the planet go? You know, here, you know, in one moment it's there, and the other moment it's not. So it proved very difficult to move the planet over, an entire Jupiter mass over, out of the line of sight to the star. We really couldn't figure out a way to do it. We tried, you know, putting in another planet. You can put in other planets, but the changes that they would induce to a Jupiter mass planet occur over much slower timescales, much slower than the orbit-to-orbit variations that are indicated by the data. So you can't think of, we had to sort of abandon the whole idea of using a single opaque body as large as Jupiter to explain the data. And instead, what we thought of was a wind, an outflow, not a single opaque body, but a collection of dust particles being spewed out from a much smaller planet, a little nugget that's inside this cloud of dust. And the cloud of dust is erratic. It's like a comet. That's the idea, is that it's spewing out dust erratically. There might even be volcanoes on the surface. And the amount of mass that's lost is prodigious in the following sense. You can estimate it from the data. The fact that it occults about 1% of the light of the star, you could use that in a back of the envelope order of magnitude estimate. You can do this at home too. It's just a couple lines of algebra. You can estimate that it's putting out something like 10 to the 11 grams per second, which is about an Earth mass per billion years. Now, that's substantial in the following sense. If you believe that the mass of the planet that's spewing out all this dust We made a further estimate of how big the underlying planet could be. And we got an estimate of something like a tenth, okay, a tenth of an Earth mass. So if you believe that it's putting out one Earth mass per gig year, and if you also calculate, as we did, that the mass of the underlying planet is not much bigger than Mercury, then the thing doesn't have very long to live. It only lasts for a tenth of a giga year, a tenth of a billion years, or about 100 million years. That's short. That's short compared to the likely age of the star, which is probably measured in billions of years. So this thing is disintegrating before our eyes. It's expected to be a short-lived phase.
Yeah, very short-lived. And from this, do we get an idea that there might have been lots of other planets that disintegrated because they were so close to their stars, and that while we're looking at solar systems, we're looking at that at stuff that we're missing. We're missing stuff, possibly.
Yeah, that's absolutely a possibility. I mean, one thing that we're missing is all the objects that the orbits just like this one. Actively disintegrating, but there are certain numbers that we're missing just because of the unfavorable orientation of the orbit, right? So this one happens to be, the orbit is aligned so that you're looking at it edge on, so that it actually passes in front of the star. But what about all those actively disintegrating planets whose orbits are tilted this way, right? Instead of viewing it edge on, you're looking at it face on, and then they'd be disintegrating, but you'd never know. Because they wouldn't be passing in front of the host star, which is in the middle. So you're certainly missing that contribution. It's a fun exercise to try to estimate how many of these things are out there. With just one object, unfortunately, the parameter space is too large to get a really good estimate. But there's certainly objects just like this one out there. I'm positive on that point. It's just hard to be it's hard to be quantitative.
Eugene, I also thought it was very interesting that the star planet pair may be very fortuitous in terms of the effective temperature of the star, because you pointed out that the star is cool enough so that these particles can condense and survive long enough to create a cometary-like tail that can obscure the star, and that it may be that a large number of these close-in roasting Earth-sized planets or smaller planets actually are evaporating, but that you don't get a cometary dust trail condensing that we can actually observe.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little bit of we called it the Goldilocks, sort of just right. All the parameters of the system are just right so that it's an observable effect. So what John is pointing out is that there are other roasting hot planets also discovered by Kepler. They're even hotter. So the effective temperature of this one that we're talking about is something like 2,000 Kelvin. I think translated into Fahrenheit, something like 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah. There are objects discovered that are even hotter. And you'd say to yourself, well, they should be disintegrating as well. Well, they are. There are a couple problems, though. The reason why we don't expect to see this kind of bizarre light curve from those hot other planets is for two reasons. One, the one that John just mentioned, it's too hot. So the dust, as it comes off the surface, just evaporates instantly in seconds. So it never gets a chance to obscure enough of the face of the star to produce a observable signature. It's too hot. Another reason is that the planets, these other roasting hot planets, they're too massive. They're known from Kepler to be a couple Earth radii. Right, so super Earths, perhaps 10 times more massive than the Earth. And the surface gravities of those planets is just too strong so that the amount of outflow that you get, yes, it's hot at the surface, but the strong gravity from these other worlds is just so strong that the gas and the dust remains confined to the surface. Whereas this object, we think the underlying planet is not much bigger than Mercury, perhaps just Mercury in size. So it has a low enough gravity that it can emit all these particulates.
There's someone in the chat room who is just wondering. We can look at the light that's emitted, or the dimming of the light that comes from stars through the Kepler Observatory. Can we also see accretion disks? Is there any accretion disks? Wouldn't be moving around in any kind of frequency that could be measured, or is that something that's picked up?
I think there are CVs, if I'm not mistaken. Cataclysmic variables, that is,
we
white dwarfs.
Several.
Yeah, in the Kepler data field. These are other sources. So white dwarfs that are accreting from companion stars, so-called cataclysmic variables. John just mentioned that there were a couple.
That's right, and they have very beautiful light curves. You see periodic outbursts where the brightness increases several fold, and then you will see rapid oscillations of the light output as well, due to waves propagating in the accretion disk. At least that's what I understand. and so we can see those things, at least in some instances. We can also, in some cases, see light reflected off of the planet. And typically we see this only in the case of a very hot, close-in giant planet like HAPP-7b, which was observed and detected, indeed, the year before Kepler launched, but it happens to reside in the Kepler field of view. So, of course, we put it on our target list. And when the planet crosses in front of the star, it drops in brightness by 0.6%. And the star is much bigger than the sun, and the planet is much bigger than Jupiter, but it's about a 1% drop in brightness. But when the planet swings around in its orbit to go behind the star, this planet is heated to about 2600 degrees Kelvin, so it's emitting thermal radiation, infrared. Some of that actually gets into the optical bandpass that we can measure with Kepler, and it increases the total brightness of the system by about 100 parts per million. And then we see that 100 part per million additional light from the planet wink out when the planet goes behind the star. And we can see that in the light curve without folding it, without doing much of any processing to it. So in some instances, we can see light reflected from the planet. And indeed, there are astronomers out there in the community who are actually coming through the Kepler data to look for instances when we have planets that don't transit their star, don't cross the star, but you'll still see this phase variation in the light from the system, kind of like seeing the phases of the moon, right? So there are people who are trying to detect, and they have detected, they're looking for brown dwarfs, and there are candidates out there for planets detected via this technique.
That's fascinating. It's just so interesting that the thermal radiation can also add to the light, the brightness that you're getting. In this case, with the hot, the hot Mercury, it's such a small planet that it doesn't have that kind of addition. Was there any kind of addition when it passed behind the sun, behind its star?
There will be, but I think it's too low. Even the mighty Kepler is not quite sensitive to detect the light from the warm dust. It's there for sure,
right.
but it's just too low in flux.
With what you've figured out about this Mercury planet, what kind? I mean, you obviously would not want to live there.
No.
What kind, from the signature, from the light, you've gotten the size, the mass of the planet. You've got maybe the radius of the dust cloud that is being emitted and being blown away from the planet as it orbits. What other factors have you, and temperature, what other factors have you been able to kind of figure out about this planet?
Well, we can say a few things about the mineralogy of the dust that's coming off. I mean, what kind of dust is it? What is it made out of? And so we did an exercise where we looked at various minerals, in particular, the minerals that comprise the Earth's mantle. So the Earth's mantle, most of it, it's made up of so-called olivines and also pyroxenes. So these are magnesium silicates. It's magnesium, silicon, and oxygen in various combinations. And what was surprising to us after doing this exercise was how different the vapor pressures are for these various minerals. And this was determined by experiments in the lab. And vapor pressure is interesting to us because it tells you what the lifetimes of these grains are. You need them to survive for long enough that they can transit across the face of the star and produce an observable signature. So it was a real surprise to us to learn that olivine, for example, you can take a micron-sized grain of olivine, a microscopic speck of olivine, and not too surprisingly, it vanishes in seconds. And the evaporation lifetime is measured in seconds. But you take the same size grain, and instead of making it out of olivine, you make it out of pyroxene. Suddenly, for reasons that I have to admit, I as an astronomer don't quite understand, this micron-sized speck of pyroxene can last for just the right amount of time, a few hours, to travel across the face of the star and produce the shadow that's required to explain the data. So our best guess right now is that, you know, it's the pyroxene that we're looking at. It's MgSiO3. We could even start arguing about chemical composition of this world, which to me is mind-boggling. I mean, 20 years ago when this whole field started, I thought, oh, we'll get some masses, we'll get orbits. It'll make it'll be a heyday for the celestial mechanicians, but not for anybody else. But now even the geologists are getting interested, which I really love. I really love that aspect of the Kepler mission is that it's producing such rich for such rich science.
And are you saying, Eugene? Are you saying are you saying that our light curves are superficial?
Superficial. not sure what you mean by that. it's only as astronomers we can only see down to optical depth unity, right? So everything is skin deep for the field of astronomy.
Right.
It's just the nature of the beast.
But it is amazing that starting from a light curve, information that's carried in the brightness of light that has traveled from a star to our observatory, that all of this information can be gathered. I mean, the amount of knowledge that allows this kind of hypothesizing and this kind of inquiry into exoplanets it's astounding all on its own.
It is. We're right in the midst of a voyage of discovery, a grand voyage of discovery that I think in some sense you could think rivals the discoveries that were made in the 1600s with the discovery of, quote, the new worlds. Well, we're doing just that, but we don't have to leave our homes or our offices in order to do this. We simply need to send out a robotic probe like Kepler to collect the data that we need in order to do this. But it's every bit as grand. It's telling us something about our place in the universe. How often is it that you find a planet like Earth around a common main sequence star like our sun? I think it's just fascinating. And this is a very good example of the variability of planetary systems out there that Kepler's revealing to us. We're not just finding out about solar systems like our own. We're also finding out a lot about planetary formation processes in general and about the wide variety of circumstances and outcomes of this, what still is a mysterious process.
Yeah, very mysterious. And Eugene, in terms of the other hypotheses that you were looking at, I mean, what's the chance that this result, we're saying that you've this is your best guess, this disintegrating planet from looking at the light curve, trying to figure out what it could possibly be, get rid of all the other possibilities, the alternative hypotheses, and this is the best guess for what the planet is. Are there any other possibilities out there? What's the likelihood of that?
Yeah, sure. That's always worth considering. We're not, 100% sure that our explanation is correct. I frankly can't think of anything else. but I should point out, right, and this is the good news. The idea that we have has certain predictions which are testable, and people we've proposed to pursue these additional experiments. One of these experiments is to measure the light curve at other wavelengths. So Kepler measures in the optical, and we would like to do it at somewhat longer wavelengths in the infrared. So maybe 1 to 2 microns wavelength. And you can do this with the Hubble Space Telescope. So John and I were on a proposal. We should hear back, I think, in a couple of weeks, whether it was accepted or not, to look with the Hubble Space Telescope at this source to measure the light curve at infrared longer wavelengths. And the prediction is, if it really is dust and not a single opaque object that's obscuring the star, if it's really dust, then and if it's micron-sized dust, then the depth of the eclipse should go down. You should, as you go to longer wavelengths of observation, you should see the dimming become less and less because the wavelengths that you're observing at are longer now than the sizes of the particles that are scattering the radiation. So when that happens, the scattering becomes less efficient. So the longer wavelength you go, the more the eclipses should disappear. So I would be super excited to see that happen, to see that observed, to see that confirmed with the Hubble Space Telescope. And we sent in a proposal. I really hope it's accepted. So you see, there are testable predictions for this idea that we can use to move forward. I should also point out that there's another prediction, which is that for a Mercury-sized object, it's sort of a negative prediction. But for a Mercury-sized object, you really don't expect, you can't, right, with today's technology, detect the Doppler signal, the Doppler shift of the star, the gravitational tug of the star due to this little tiny planet. So we predict that if you were to look with the best spectrometers that we have, the most sensitive ones that we have today, you really shouldn't see a signal. And other people, the people right next door to me, Jeff Marcy, who loves to beat up on every idea I propose, he's going out with the Keck telescope now with Andrew Howard, and they're looking for Doppler shifts for the star. So far, nothing, which is immensely gratifying to me.
I mean, it would be like shooting fish in a barrel if this were a stellar mass companion.
Yeah.
In some of the alternative scenarios, and the fact that there's a null result indicates that it's either something much more exotic and therefore more unlikely, or directly supports our hypothesis.
Right. So there are tests, and we're trying to pursue them. I can't think of any alternatives though. Despite trying very hard.
Maybe somebody else, a graduate student or something, will be able to come up with an alternative hypothesis that you can test as well.
Yes. The field is open.
That's right. That's the beauty of all this, because you have a new instrument like Kepler that's giving you an interesting and new and novel signature, and it's a bit of a mystery, a whodunit, as to what's actually going on. So Eugene and his team, I believe, have come up with the most credible and plausible hypothesis explanation for what's going on. And so far, it's holding up. And we'll continue that work until we achieve good confidence that it's the best explanation and that we've closed the books on the others. But even if that turns out not to be the case, then I think we'll have learned something new. And it may point us to a new collection of questions with equally interesting answers.
Yeah, well, my fingers are crossed for your time on Hubble and that you'll be able to move forward with the actual experimental observation, try and see if that will work. As we come to the end of the show here, I'm just wondering if we can do a quick wrap-up. How many planets has Kepler found so far? Where are we in the count?
Well, at this point, we have identified over 2,300 planetary candidates, most of which still await vetting and confirmation. We've confirmed over 60 planets, but we believe, based on the statistics so far, that at least 80% of those 2,300 are valid planets. And indeed, About 900 of those are found in multiple transiting planet systems, where we see not just one planet transiting, but two, three, four, as many as six. And we believe with high confidence that at least 90%+ of those systems are real planetary systems. So solar systems are not rare. They appear to be very common, and they appear to be very flat like our own, so that the planet's orbits tend to lie in the same plane, on the same surface.
And where are we going to be going with the next questions now that you've got this really interesting result? It's obviously going to be driving some new questions as you even try and experiment to confirm what you've got. Is there anything, any new information that you've gotten that's causing you to look at the data you get from Kepler any differently?
I think that's for Eugene. Is that right?
Not sure how to answer that question. In with regards to the disintegrating planet, or
has the disintegrating?
Well, as a follow-up study, we are. It's a theoretical study. We have a follow-up theoretical study, which is to calculate from first principles what the mass loss rate of this planet should be. Now, we estimated from the Kepler data that it should be putting out about one Earth mass per gigayear. And that's almost straight from the data, without much theoretical bias. But what we'd like to do is have a sort of first principle, starting from scratch, right? The problem was well-defined. If you take Mercury and put it at 0.01 AU, so 1/100th the distance between the Earth and the Sun, you'd put it that much closer in, how long would it take to go away? And that, mm-hmm. I think, is a well-defined question. It's never really been answered before because we didn't have, you know, reason to calculate it. But we're calculating it now. So it's a hydrodynamics question. It involves thermal winds, radiative transfer. So it's a sort of follow-up theoretical study that I'm pursuing now with a graduate student, Daniel Perez Becker.
That should be really interesting, especially since we've seen Mercury. We've actually imaged it. We've gotten a mission to Mercury. And so we have a lot of information about this planet in our own solar system that we wouldn't actually have in other solar systems that could you know, give more insight into what you're actually looking at and what you come up with.
Absolutely.
Right. And further, we're also making new observations with Kepler. We also have the ability to monitor as many as 512 stars at 1-minute intervals, which will be very important for this object because being such a short period object with a nearly 16-hour orbit, the transit features themselves are very short and would benefit from the 1-minute resolution so that the modeling has more details that we can try to match up. So that's about to start, actually.
And I can't wait to hear the news and be able to talk about it and tell everybody what you guys are learning. There is so much information. Every time I hear a story, talk with somebody who's working on Kepler, the amount of data you have, the amount of information that's coming out of this mission is just massive, and it's driving astronomy forward. It really is pushing us forward into the future and our understanding of where we are in the universe, what other things are in the universe with us. And thank you so much for doing the work on it. Eugene, both of you are passionate about planets. We'll start with Eugene. What is your favorite exoplanet?
Favorite exoplanet? Well, I'll just say this one. It's an easy choice to make, actually. I hope it really is a planet, first of all. I hope we're right. but I should say
a lot of them, right? Candidate.
Yeah, I mean, I should say the reason why it's my favorite is because it really is, as John pointed out, a kind of a mystery story. It's the kind of work I like to do best. It's the most enjoyable, is what I mean. Mm-hmm. You're given something, and nobody can agree on what the heck it is. So it's your job to figure it out. And that's, I can't think of a more enjoyable way to spend my workday. So this particular Kepler target gave me that opportunity. And for several months and continuing, I've derived great satisfaction from that. I just hope I'm right.
We hope so, too. John, do you have a favorite exoplanet?
Well, now you would be asking a parent to choose their favorite child and name that child in public. So I'm not sure if I can do that. However, I can admit that I'm particularly drawn to the smaller and, you know, cuter children that Kepler has produced. And certainly those that display a lot of character and personality, like 12557548, certainly warrant a lot of attention and a lot of enthusiasm.
And have you had the opportunity, being at SETI, have you had the opportunity to meet Jodie Foster? Somebody in the chat room is dying to know.
I have met the inspiration for the character Ellie Arroway, whom she portrayed in Contact, but no, unfortunately, I have not had the opportunity to meet Jodie Foster herself.
That would be great, though. But I think meeting the inspiration for the character, that's right up there as well. That's fantastic. Inspiring people abound, and both of you fall into that category. Thank you very much for joining me today and sharing the passion that you have for this research and for sharing the story of this disintegrating planet, I believe, which is 12557548. Is that right?
That's right.
Very good.
I had that written down. I couldn't remember that.
Well, thank you so much for putting together such a great show.
You're welcome.
It was
thank
a lot
you
of
very
fun.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, everybody, if you are interested in more information about Kepler and the news that it is producing, the news of exoplanets like this dusty disintegrating one, you can find that information at nasa.gov/Kepler. Additionally, there is a Twitter page, or Twitter account at NASA Kepler. And there's also a Facebook page, which is NASA's Kepler mission. So Facebook.com, NASA's Kepler mission is the Facebook page. So I absolutely recommend favoriting those sites, checking them out on a regular basis, because this is not the only story to come out of Kepler, and there will be many more, especially since the budget for Kepler has been continued and maintained. Yay! We want this mission to keep going. Also, I want to thank, once again, Eugene Chang and John Jenkins for joining me here. If you want to find out more about either of them, Eugene works as a professor at UC Berkeley, and John Jenkins is at the SETI Institute. And that's it for today. I'm Dr. Kiki. This has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And until next week, you can follow my pursuits all over the interwebs. I'm Dr. Kiki on Twitter, Facebook, Kiki Sanford on Google+. I have a YouTube page, which is Kiki Sanford also. And if you just can't get enough science in your week, there is more. You can also find my show, This Week in Science, on the Twit Network, broadcasting on Thursday, 7:30 p.m. Pacific time as well. And you go to twist.org to find past episodes of that show. Go to twit.tv/Kiki to download past episodes of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And on Fridays around noon, I do a Justin TV chat, Justin TV/Dr. Kiki science chat. Look for the science chat. You will find me. Next week, we are going to be talking about the Venus transit, which we didn't actually talk about in relation to Kepler, but NASA's doing some amazing stuff with the Venus transit, and you will be able to view it through NASA. NASA is helping out with that. So go check NASA out. They're doing cool stuff. If you're interested in the Venus transit, it's not going to happen again for, I don't know, until 2117, something like that. So it's quite a ways off. I'm probably not going to be alive then. So I'm going to make an effort to see the Venus transit this next week. If you do miss it, or even if you do catch it, next Thursday, we're going to be talking about it in relation to the Solar Dynamics Observatory. Next week, it's Solar Dynamics all the way. I was trying to get Camilla Corona the chicken on, but that isn't happening. It's going to be a scientist, which I think that'll be just as good. I'll see you next week. I really do hope that you come back. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. This week, all I ask is 1 hour a week, even though I have a lot more for you. And remember, I hope this 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week. From the International Space Station, astronaut Don Pettit, I believe is his last name, opening up one of the viewing areas, little windows, so he could look at a moonrise. It's kind of an interesting little silent meditation on where we are. Well, I guess, you know, people floating in space and the moon. Thank you guys so much for joining once again. It was really great. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Lots of fun.
Hello. Bye.
Bye. Have a wonderful day. Wonderful evening. Enjoy.